Morning, everyone, and welcome to the court. We have one case today, United States v. Kershaw, and because this is a TJAG-certified case, the government will be arguing first. So, Major Levine, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? And Major Johnson, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellee? Very well, then, please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court, I am Major Ashley Torkelson Levine, and along with Colonel Matthew Chalka, we represent the United States. Chief Judge Olson, I'd like to respectfully request 3 minutes of rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. The court below did not set aside appellee's conviction out of doubt about what happened to the 6-year-old child. The court did so based on a mistaken belief that it had no other option. This was error. This court should vacate the decision below for 3 reasons. First, because the court below erred as a matter of law when it concluded that a variance analysis could not be conducted on appeal. Second, because this court's recent case in Patterson does not control here. And third, because factual sufficiency review is concerned with the elements of the offense. I'd like to first begin with this court's recent decision in Patterson. In Patterson, this court assessed whether the factual sufficiency review below was legal error, but AFCA determined that based upon the facts alleged, the specification was not proven beyond a reasonable doubt. The same is not true here. Yes, they came to a similar conclusion and ultimately set aside the conviction based upon the date, but they did so after misstating their own discretion. The Kershaw court explicitly stated that they could not conduct a variance analysis on appeal, and that is legal error, which this court must correct and send back for a new factual sufficiency review.
So is it the government's position that the CCA was required to conduct the variance analysis, or are you simply saying they misunderstood that they were authorized to?
I think there's 2 points here. First, it is an error of law that the court determined that a variance analysis could not be conducted on appeal. But second, yes, a variance analysis should be conducted on appeal when there is a discrepancy.
Now, you say should. Question, though, is must.
Yes, a variance analysis must be conducted on appeal when there is a discrepancy, when the evidence at trial establishes the offense, but there is a discrepancy between the allegation and the proof.
Now, where do you get that requirement in the rules or the statutes that a CCA is required to conduct a variance analysis?
So this court in U.S. v. Dotson has previously explained this before. And in Dotson, this court noted that it is fundamental that the allegation and the proof correspond. They must substantially correspond. Where they don't, there is either a failure of proof or a variance issue. And it all depends upon the scope and meaning of the allegation. In all matters which are the essence of the crime, that is a failure of proof. But in immaterial averments, those that just describe the offense, like the date here, those should be conducted under a variance analysis.
Counsel, can I ask about how that variance analysis would work? If the panel had said, you know, we're looking at this and it says May of 2016, but we really think it was the summer of 2015, we find him guilty and we modify it. Then on appeal, the variance analysis would look, was that a fatal variance? Could they make such a big modification from May of 2016 to summer of 2015? But they didn't do that. They just found him guilty of doing it in May of 2016. And so are you saying that the Air Force Court should have said something like, the panel could have done a variance finding it to be the summer of 2015, and if they had done that, that would not have been a fatal variance, and therefore we find the specification, the proof to be factually sufficient, even though we don't believe it actually occurred on the date that it was charged. Is that essentially what you think the Air Force Court should do?
No, Your Honor. And I think I'd like to explain it in 2 different ways. First is that variance is a term of art that can be analyzed in 2 different ways. One is via exceptions and substitutions under RCM 917, and the other is variance on appeal. The former is not what we are asking the court to do and not what we are stating that the CCA should have done. Instead, we're addressing the variance.
Well, I understand that. I understand that. I mean, the finding is what it is. But what you're essentially saying is that they would have to look at this in the same way and say, if the panel had made a variance, that would not have been a fatal variance. And therefore, we find it to be factually sufficient. That's essentially your argument, isn't it?
In this case,
we're not making a variance on appeal, but we're just looking and saying if the panel had made a variance, that would not have been a fatal variance, and therefore we find it factually sufficient.
No, we are not asking this court to make the variance analysis here.
I'm just saying this is what you think the Air Force Court should have done. What you're saying is when you're confronted with a situation where the evidence does not correspond, you should say, well, if the panel had found, but it didn't find, but if it had found that the person was guilty at that date, that wouldn't have been a fatal variance, and therefore it's factually sufficient.
We think that the CCA here, under Article 66 review, should just be looking at the elements of the offense and not be considered with what the panel did or did not do for their own variance instruction, whether or not it happened. But instead, the CCA should be looking at the elements of the offense and determining whether if they themselves are convinced beyond a reasonable doubt, and if they believe that there is a discrepancy between the proof and the pleading, then they themselves do a variance analysis of whether that variance was material and whether it prejudiced the accused.
But that's what they did. They performed a factual sufficiency analysis. They looked at the charge. They said the evidence, they're not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt. What is it? That's exactly what they did. What is it you want them to do? Be more specific about what it is you want them to do differently.
Well, the key difference here between what you're describing, which is what happened in Patterson and what happened here, is that the AFCA court noted that they could not conduct a variance analysis. That is an error of law. And so where that was not announced in Patterson, that they, in their factual sufficiency review, they included an error of law, where that is what has happened in Kershaw here. And in this court's decision in Patterson, you specifically noted that what was not at issue was whether a CCA would have approved of the offense had the discrepancy not existed. And that is at issue in this case, because the Kershaw court has specifically stated that variance cannot be conducted on appeal. And that error of law must be corrected by this court.
So let me then ask, if the CCA had not said that, if the CCA instead had said, we have the authority to engage in a variance analysis, but we choose not to. We are going to look at this strictly through the prism of factual sufficiency, and we find it is factually insufficient. What would the government's position be then?
The CCA does not have the discretion to conduct a variance analysis. They must conduct a variance analysis.
And going back to a question I asked at the outset, where does that requirement come from?
First and foremost, we can look at precedent from this court and the Supreme Court of the United States. We use this court in U.S. v. Dotson explaining that immaterial averments that merely describe the offense are not failures of proof. And so that would be inappropriate for just switching it into a factual sufficiency review as opposed to describing a variance. But more importantly, Article 66 itself, by its plain language, requires the CCAs to affirm a finding affirm only such findings of guilt that are correct in law and fact. Now, a finding is described as an offense that is proven beyond a reasonable doubt. We know that proof beyond a reasonable doubt only applies to the elements of the offense.
Counsel, the panel was instructed. In Specification 1 of the charge, the accused is charged with the offense of rape of a child. To find the accused guilty of the offense, you must be convinced by legal and competent evidence beyond a reasonable doubt of the following elements: that at or near San Antonio, Texas, between on or about 1 April 2016 and on or about 30 April 2016, Staff Sergeant Kershaw committed a sexual act upon him. Is that instruction just wrong, that when you instruct the panel that they have to find the specification beyond a reasonable doubt and you specify the location and the date, that that's just wrong?
We think perhaps the instruction provides additional information that is not necessary.
Did you object to that at trial?
We did not object to that at trial.
Isn't this the standard way that specifications have been the instructions have been used for time immemorial, that you have to find the facts of the specification beyond a reasonable doubt?
Yes, but it is, yes, Your Honor, but it is not the law of the case. The law of the case is that in order for the accused to be guilty of the offense, the elements must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. We know that based upon RCM 918. We also can see that in greater context within the MCM. In RCM 307, in order to state an offense, you're required to allege the elements of the offense. And under RCM 917, in order to be not guilty of the offense, it is because an essential element hasn't been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, just because
going forward, military judges should just say, look, you've got to find these three elements, but you do not have to find the location or the date.
I don't think the court needs to go so far as you don't need to find the date or the location, because those are important to describe the offense. It's important because there might be a variance.
And why is it important to describe the offense? Like, why does the government wrote the charge sheet? They wrote these charges. Why put the dates and the names in there? If they're not elements, why put them in?
Your Honor, it's critical that they're included for the accused notice and to protect the accused against double jeopardy.
Right. So the Constitution requires them to be in there, right?
Yes.
But they don't have to be proven.
No, they do not have to be proven. Only elements are required.
And what do you cite for that?
In re-
what
Winch-
court has ever held that they, I mean, we have a decision from the 1950s, but has any civilian court, has the Supreme Court ever said that you don't have to prove the identity of the victim in a crime?
In re Winship provides that only the elements are required to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. That has been clarified multiple times by the Supreme Court of the United States.
Don't you think it would have come up sometime in 250 years that you don't have to prove the identity of the victim?
Yes, and the Supreme Court has absolutely stated that only the elements are required to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and federal civilian courts all the time do variants on the date, on the location, other similar issues. And so this is not anything new, not in the federal civilian realm, but also historically in the military justice realm. As this court has previously done, again, described in Dotson, but we can see the CCAs doing it and this court approving it.
So I have another question. You say that the CCA has this authority to conduct a variance analysis, but I don't see how that's consistent with what we recently said in English, right? We said, by finding the evidence did not support the facts as charged, the CCA effectively concluded that appellant was not guilty of the specification. The ACCA had two options. One, set aside the findings as the specification, or two, affirm a lesser included offense. I don't see any third option to conduct a variance analysis.
Well, English was different because the government began by narrowing an essential element of the offense. And
so your variance analysis only applies to what you call non-elements?
It's typical that a variance is addressed where we're talking about those immaterial averments, but this court has held previously in U.S. v. Finch that a variance can occur for an essential element, but this court found that it was not fatal because it did not impact the core of the offense. And that, I think, highlights the issue in English is where we're changing.
So we have the government's position is because English and Lubaski don't deal with time, they're totally distinguishable and have no relevance to what we're doing in this case.
No, not at all. I think they're very relevant here. And in terms of Lubaski, Lubaski is different for a couple reasons. First, in Lubaski, that was a legal sufficiency review, and the court was looking at, of course, the elements of the offense, but as Congress drafted the elements, the way that it was worded by the government, it was not actually a crime. It wasn't a crime for the accused to steal from the person whose credit cards it was. Instead, it was only actually a crime against the merchant. And so, of course, it wasn't going to be legally sufficient. That is very different from the case here, where we have a variance on the date that has absolutely no impact on the nature of the offense, the scope of the offense, the defense in actuality. We know that the defense knew of the variance throughout trial, was able to argue towards the variance instruction at trial, and so he cannot argue either at trial or on appeal that he was surprised by the variance.
So, counsel, the question, this kind of a combination of the questions that the Chief Judge and Judge Hardy have been trying to get at, for want of a better word, our precedence in this area is kind of all over the map, as you've demonstrated. Lubaski, English, Dotson, Hunt. So is it the government's position, or does this court need to overrule some of the earlier precedents? Or I guess an easier way to say is, does this court, is it the government's position that the court needs to clarify what the variance rules are?
Your Honor, if I could explain what I think has happened here, is that we historically conducted a variance analysis just as they do in the federal civilian realm. Then somewhere along the lines, precedent from this court has confused the CCAs, and at least in Kershaw, it's clear that it's Parker that is the instigator that is confusing the CCAs into thinking that non-element facts need to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So the government would ask that it is critical of this court to clarify Parker. Parker stands for the unremarkable conclusion that presenting zero substantive evidence of a crime is grounds for dismissal. However, the court here found that Parker stands for, quote, the government's failure to prove the charged offense occurred during the charge time frame rendered the evidence legally insufficient. That is not what Parker found at all. In fact, variance was not at issue. So the government would be asking not to overturn any precedent. There isn't any precedent that needs to be overturned. English is consistent. Lubasky is consistent. The only request is that Parker be clarified and the court affirm that variance exists when the evidence at trial proves the offense, but the proof does not align precisely with that. And I think it's critical that we do that, because if not, the only way that the CCA can come to a determination that a offense is factually insufficient based upon a non-element fact is to raise that burden of proof of the non-element fact to proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That exceeds the CCA's statutory authority, that is ultra vires, but it also is potentially either, and again, this is if Parker stands, it either is setting the precedent that a non-essential fact is an element, which it is not, or that the CCAs can demand proof beyond a reasonable doubt for a non-element fact, which would be above and beyond what any trial court in this country requires. And that would violate separation of powers, as Congress is the only branch who can define the elements of the offense.
So, counsel, how does your approach in this case mesh with our recent opinion in Patterson, where we reinforced the fact that the factual sufficiency authority of CCAs is very great?
Patterson is different in that regard, because Patterson did not delve into whether there was an error of law. And we don't know in Patterson whether there was an error of law, because unlike Kershaw, they did not directly address whether or not there was a variance, whether they could or could not address a variance. And we know that based upon this statement that what was not at issue was whether the CCAs could have approved this. Now, Patterson also didn't explain what authority the CCAs have for overturning a conviction for a non-element, but I think one critical difference between Patterson and Kershaw, additional difference between Patterson and Kershaw, is this court's remedial paragraph in Patterson. And there, this court noted that careful drafting, withdrawal and re-referral under RCM 304, and exceptions and substitutions under RCM 917 would prevent the government from, or the accused from getting to the position where we're at the CCA or where we're at this court. But this case is proof positive that no amount of good prosecution can prevent getting to this situation here. The government can prove all of the elements beyond a reasonable doubt, can present substantial evidence of the charge timeline, so much so that the panel rejects exceptions and substitutions, yet the CCA can still overturn the conviction based upon a non-element fact that is not required to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt at trial and is not required to be proven in any other court in the country.
I see that your time has expired. Let me see if there are further questions from the bench. Thank you. Major Johnson.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Major Frederick Johnson, and along with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Alan Abrams, I represent the appellee in this case, Staff Sergeant John Kershaw. As in United States versus Patterson, the Air Force Court's decision to set aside the findings of guilty for factual insufficiency was within its discretion. In this case, it exercised the same authority to set aside findings based on a difference between dates in the findings and those in the evidence. This court should therefore affirm the Air Force Court's decision, as it did in Patterson.
Major Johnson, may I ask you what, from your view, the CCA meant when it said the following? Quote, here the members were given a variance instruction before deliberating on findings and subsequently made no changes to the charged time frame of the offense. Therefore, there is no variance issue for this court to consider, end quote. What was the CCA trying to indicate there, in your view?
Your Honor, the CCA was indicating that it is only reviewing the findings of the court, and where that court didn't use any exceptions or substitutions and didn't create a variance, the CCA is then left to review what the court actually found and look at whether that is factually sufficient based on the evidence. The court's not saying that it couldn't ever do a variance, that a variance is beyond its authority. The court, as you quoted, Your Honor, said there is no variance to review. It's looking at what actually happened at the court below and finding that that means that there's nothing for it to do in that regard.
Now, it doesn't quite say to review. It says to consider. No variance issue to consider. Why couldn't the CCA have looked at this and said, on or about, therefore, there is some leeway here, and we look and see, either through a variance analysis or through factual sufficiency, whether it happened on or about?
The court did look, Your Honor, at whether it happened on or about. It goes on, as it's conducting its factual sufficiency analysis, to note that that is really the key question that it has before it. But if it had been within the range of on or about, which, as this court noted in U.S. v. Simmons, is generally a range of days to weeks, if it had fallen within that, it would be factually sufficient because the government would have proven what it alleged. It would have proven that it happened on or about. But to say that it can conduct some variance analysis, as the government urges, where it falls outside that range of on or about, is asking the CCA to affirm a conviction on a basis that is different from what the trial court used to convict.
So they don't need to look at the materiality and prejudicial effect of the difference in the dates?
Not where there hasn't been a change in the dates at the trial level, Your Honor.
Why not? Let's tease that out a little bit. Why couldn't they have looked at this and said, separate from factual sufficiency determination, we're going to look at this through the prism of variance analysis. We see these dates. The government and the dissent have a different view of how those dates play out. But why couldn't the CCA have looked at this and said, okay, these dates were outside of a few weeks, but we're going to look and see whether those dates that were alleged really had a prejudicial effect. They were material and had a prejudicial effect on the prosecution.
Because that's not what the court-martial found. That's not the findings that were entered as a judgment of the lower court. And for a court of appeals to then look at it and say, well, let's see if there was any prejudice from this change that didn't happen, is affirming a conviction on a different basis than the judgment was entered. And that's why it's essential for the court to look at what actually happened at trial and to review the findings. The government, in much of its briefing, frames this as a problem that involves a difference between pleading and proof. But really, the question that the court was answering is there a difference between the evidence and the findings? Because courts of appeal review findings. They don't review pleadings on their own. And where those findings weren't changed, whether there would have been some prejudice or some other problem if the findings had been changed is not a material question because they weren't. It's purely hypothetical to look at what would have happened if the court reached a different decision below. And that's why this court has been clear in United States versus Lebaski that variance occurs at trial, not at the appellate level. And it's been consistent through United States versus English to say that courts of appeals cannot enter findings by exceptions and substitutions. Recognizing those limitations, the Air Force Court looked at what happened below and said there was no variance. And because of that, it also noted that factual sufficiency review was more appropriate here. It said this issue was more appropriately analyzed using factual sufficiency. And that's an exercise of discretion. The very same discretion that this court found the Air Force Court properly exercised in United States versus Patterson. And contrary to the government's assertion, the exercise here is the same as the exercise in Patterson. It is concluding that the best way to review this is as a matter of factual sufficiency. That's different from what the civilian courts do because it's an authority that the civilian appellate courts don't have. The civilian courts, when they look at differences in dates or locations as a matter of variance, they're looking for legal error. They're not looking for factual sufficiency because they don't have the awesome plenary de novo power of factual sufficiency review that the courts of criminal appeals can exercise. And it's also important to keep the context of this case in mind because this case, as did Patterson, falls under the previous standard for factual sufficiency review, the one that applies to specifications that allege offenses on or before the 1st of January 2021. As the specification in this case did. Because of that, the discretion of the Air Force Court was even greater. That is the standard under which this court has found an awesome plenary de novo power to review evidence and determine whether those judges themselves are convinced of the accused guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And it's really the same decision that the members could have made at trial. As the court noted when questioning the government, the instruction given at trial is that this is something that must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. If the members had reasonable doubt about that, that could be enough for them to decide that they're going to vote for not guilty. They decided not to, but when the Air Force Court looked at it, they themselves determined that they were not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt. And that was an appropriate exercise of their discretion.
So I just want to make sure I understand your argument. Because it's important.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, different facts. Let's say that it's alleged that the offense occurred on 1 January. All of the evidence indicates that, in fact, it happened on what, 1 April. Does, in your view, does the CCA have the authority to say, well, there was that difference in the context of this trial was not material and was not prejudicial? Or does a CCA not have the ability to engage in that analysis?
The CCA does not have the ability to engage in that analysis if there was no variance below. If the
So with those facts, you're saying that they have no authority to look at materiality and the prejudicial effect. It is simply a factual sufficiency determination issue before the CCA.
Yes, Your Honor, at that point.
Now, when you talk about if the panel had made exceptions and substitutions and had changed it, again, for the sake of the hypothetical, to 1 April, then the CCA would have the authority to look at it and say whether or not it was material and prejudicial?
Yes, Your Honor.
And why does the trier of fact get to become the gatekeeper on whether the CCA can engage in that analysis?
Because the trier of fact makes the findings that become the judgment. And that's what an appellate court reviews. The appellate court is not looking, broadly, should this person have been convicted? They are looking at, are the findings as entered by the trial court supported by the evidence? That's the factual sufficiency review.
And so your position is CCA may never engage in variance analysis, and the government's position is CCA must always engage in variance analysis.
Our position, Your Honor, is that the CCA may never engage in variance analysis where there hasn't been a variance below, which is consistent with this Court's opinion in Lebaski, where it noted that variance occurs at trial, not at the appellate level. In fact, the Court went to some length in Lebaski to sort of describe the variance analysis that it could have conducted if there had been a variance, if there had been findings by exceptions and substitutions. But since it wasn't, the Court declined to engage in that analysis.
And so from your perspective, that quote that I read from the CCA opinion is simply capturing your position?
Yes, Your Honor. It's observing that there is no variance for it to review because, as it reviews the findings of the trial court, the findings are exactly as they were alleged. So there's no variance to review. That doesn't mean there's nothing to review. They still have to review factual sufficiency. And as the Court did, it can still look at whether those dates fall within the range of on or about, which is what the government charged. That's one of the many tools that this Court noted the government has available to it. It can charge in a way that leaves some leeway, because dates can be difficult to prove. The problem here, just like the problem in Patterson, is that even with that leeway afforded by the on or about language, the evidence placed the alleged offenses so far outside of the charge time frame that it's outside of the range of on or about. And the government also points to, you know, its use of some of these other tools that the Court noted in Patterson, such as seeking a variance instructions, and says, well, if that still didn't work and we're still here, so those must not be enough. But the problem is that the availability of tools does not guarantee their success. The government did request a variance instruction. It could have also withdrawn and dismissed charges and re-preferred when it realized that the evidence didn't match what it had charged. It chose not to do that. There may have been some other tools it could have used, but at the end of the day, whatever tools it chose to use doesn't necessarily mean those are going to be successful. And if they weren't, and the Court of Criminal Appeals, as it did here, determines that the evidence is factually insufficient to support the findings of the lower court, that's just the outcome of the judicial process. That's how it goes sometimes. The government can do everything right and still come up short, just like a defendant could mount the strongest defense possible and still get convicted. Sometimes these things happen, and it is within the discretion of a court of criminal appeals to set aside findings when that court itself believes that the evidence does not support the findings of the lower court.
So, counsel, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked the government. In looking at our precedents, do you see a disconnect between the line of cases from Hunt through Dotson or even Patterson? And if so, does the court need to either overrule some of the older cases or to clarify the rules with regards to variance?
I don't see really a disconnect, Your Honor. I see a development of the law over time. The government pointed very, very much to United States versus Dotson, which is a case from 1968. And I think one of the biggest differences from them to now is we've seen more of the development of the case law around factual sufficiency review. We now know just how important, especially under the previous standard, that authority and that discretion is, that awesome plenary de novo power of review. And as that has developed, the cases that have developed around it, such as Hunt, haven't really been inconsistent with that. Hunt was presented as a variance analysis primarily because that's how the appellant raised it. The appellant asked for a variance analysis. But really the key in Hunt was the language on or about. The court looked at the evidence in Hunt and said that that was within that range of days to weeks that constitutes being on or about a charged date. Essentially, in Hunt, the government proved what it charged because it was close enough to be within that flexible range. And I do also want to address the government's position on United States versus Parker, that certainly the Air Force Court in Patterson relied more heavily on that than it did in Kershaw in exercising the discretion that this court later affirmed. But Parker, the court repeatedly said that they had to prove that it happened in 1995. There was some evidence admitted for potentially other purposes of an offense occurring earlier in 1993, but this court's repeated insistence that they needed to prove that it happened in 1995 was key. That was the reason that the court ultimately found that it was error to not accept or to not grant the defense's 917 motion.
But counsel, can't Parker be distinguished in that there the lack of evidence versus in this instance, there was evidence, albeit conflicting, about the timeline or the time period of when this offense occurred. And so I think that you can distinguish that whole idea of the holding of Parker. Obviously, when there is no evidence at all, that's a different scenario versus there is conflicting evidence and how the panel or the lower court views that evidence.
But in Parker, Your Honor, there was evidence of an offense that occurred seemingly in 1993. It was the government acts like that evidence simply doesn't exist for the purposes of proving facts because it was admitted for a different purpose. But ultimately, it was enough for the panel below, for the court-martial, to enter a finding of guilty. The court's clear indication, what the court said in Parker, was not that this 917 motion should have been granted because there was no evidence. It said there was no evidence that this occurred in 1995. And the fact that the court felt necessary to specify that there was no evidence that it occurred in 1995 says what the ultimate holding of that court should stand for, that all the facts alleged by the government, including dates, need to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's then consistent with United States versus English, where the court held that when the government chooses to narrow the time frame, that it must prove the facts that it used, or excuse me, when it chooses to narrow the scope of the charged misconduct, that it must then prove the facts that it has chosen to allege. The government controls the charge sheet. And when the Court of Criminal Appeals is reviewing the findings entered by a court, it is well within its discretion, as this court found in United States versus Patterson, to find the evidence that doesn't support those alleged facts makes the finding factually insufficient.
Counsel, on that last point, the government started by making three points, and the third point was that factual sufficiency review should concern only the elements of the offense. In other words, if you're a CCA judge, you should only look to see whether the elements of the offense have been proven beyond a reasonable doubt and not anything else. In other words, putting aside variance and all that other stuff, just doing factual sufficiency review, were the elements of the offense proved beyond a reasonable doubt? If they were, then nothing else matters. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. That's inconsistent with the court's holding in English, where the court held that when the government chooses to narrow the scope of the charge time frame, narrow the scope of the alleged misconduct, it must then prove those facts beyond a reasonable doubt. And it's also inconsistent with this court's recent holding in Patterson, where the Air Force Court exercised the very same discretion to set something aside as factually insufficient based on a difference in dates between the evidence and the findings. And this court found that that was well within the discretion. If the court was limited to only looking at the statutory elements of an offense, Patterson would have been different, English would have been different, that whole line of cases would have come out differently. And standing here today, with the benefit of those cases, we know that this was an appropriate exercise of the Air Force Court's discretion, and one that is worthy of affirmance, just as this court did in United States versus Patterson.
Further questions? You may briefly conclude if you wish.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court should hold that under the previous Article 66 factual sufficiency review standard, a CCA acts within its discretion when it conducts a factual sufficiency review and sets aside a finding based on a difference between the dates in the evidence and the dates in the findings, consistent with United States versus Patterson.
Thank you, Major Johnson.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Major Levine.
I'd like to first touch on your question about whether factual sufficiency concerns the elements of the offense. And this court just last term in May in U.S. v. CT noted that when an appellant asks for a factual sufficiency review, it is asking a CCA to look and determine whether the elements are proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And this makes sense considering that Article 66 review is concerned with the findings. And findings, again, as we've discussed, are proved beyond a reasonable doubt That burden only applies to the elements of the offense. And considering the greater context here, we know that that makes sense because legal sufficiency also includes the elements of the offense, but also a CCA's authority to approve a lesser-included offense exists because a lesser-included offense also is determined by the elements of the offense. If it is the opposite, if it is true that the CCA can require proof beyond a reasonable doubt of a non-element fact, then that is allowing the CCA to, after the fact, raise a burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, again, that doesn't exist anywhere else in this country. And
why is that true? I mean, if you say, well, the elements don't care who the victim is, but then the government comes in and narrows that. They say, we could convict this person of killing anybody, but he didn't kill anybody, he killed Bob. And then it turns out it wasn't Bob, it was John. Why isn't the CCA allowed to take the government at its word and just say, you could have proven anybody, but you came in and promised the jury you were going to prove that it was Bob, but it wasn't Bob. So why, they're not broadening the offense. The government narrowed the offense. But
sure.
why can't the CCA hold the government to that?
I think a couple reasons. First, because this precedent here and in the federal civilian realm requires variance to be addressed. But also, things like Article 59A.
On that point, so the government has conceded in the past, and this court has held that the appellate courts, the CCAs, can't find guilt by substitutions and exceptions. And the government's not challenging that now, right? Right. So if what would the point be of making clear that the CCAs can't find guilt by exceptions and substitutions if they could then turn around and do a variance analysis as if they had done an exception and substitution?
Because variance can be analyzed in two different ways, and it goes back to your original question that the variance analysis itself covers all of those concerns that you have. It covers the concerns
of whether the government's being very specific here. They're saying the CCA should perform a variance analysis as if the panel had found guilt by exceptions and substitutions. As a matter of fact, not only may they, but they should, or even must. But what's the point then? Why not just allow the CCA to find guilt by findings and by exceptions and substitutions, and then perform the variance analysis on their own exceptions and substitutions? What is the point of saying they don't have that authority if they can do the exact same variance analysis without doing it?
I see my time No, it hasn't. Because in
actually, it has. But please respond. Please respond.
I knew it happened. So sorry. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Because in justice, we do not overturn errors of law without assessing the prejudice. We see that in Article 59A, and the prejudice it protects against overturning convictions on a technicality while also protecting the accused from due process.
But, so is that holding? That was the holding in English. That was the QP, right? Whether or not the CCAs can find guilt by exceptions and substitutions. Was that whole point moot?
No, because we're not asking the CCA to make exceptions and
substitutions. Right, but you want the court to then pretend as if it had found guilt by exceptions and substitutions and perform a variance analysis.
Because
right.
Article 66 is addressing the findings, and so...
So what is the point? Like, if it doesn't matter whether they do the exceptions and substitutions or they don't, they do the same analysis either way, what was the point of English?
The mandate of Article 66 is that only findings of fact that are approved by fact and law should be approved. And here, where we're talking about a variance should have been done, then the CCA is mandated to only affirm the finding. And the finding is only about the elements. It is not concerned with the immaterial averments of the specification, only the elements there.
Judge Spahr.
I hate to prolong this, but I'm still a little confused about your elements and fact distinction in the charging document, charge sheet. And what would be the situation if the government had charged a specific date, not on or about, but a specific date, and the evidence had shown that it wasn't that date, it was 3 weeks earlier or 3 weeks later, and the members simply return a finding of guilty on the specific date? On appeal, what happens there? I mean, The CCA is now getting ready to do its factual sufficiency review. You seem to be saying, and I might be misunderstanding you, but you seem to be suggesting that that date, specific as it is, did not have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And therefore, the fact that that the evidence is contrary to that specific date means that there is no problem from a factual sufficiency review or even a legal sufficiency review. Is that what you're...
That is correct. It would not matter if the government alleged a specific date, and that is, again, where the variance analysis comes in, because a CCA is going to determine whether the new date that they think, based upon the evidence it was, did it impact any of the elements? Or is the finding here that's based upon the elements, is it materially prejudiced, or, and if it is, did it prejudice the accused?
But then why do we require the government on these dates to plead on or about as opposed to a specific date?
Because it's required under RCM 307 for notice purposes and to protect the accused from double jeopardy.
Well, that's my point. I guess that's what I thought. But your suggestion would seem to fly in the face of that requirement or that rationale for requiring an on or about language in a specification in which the government may not be sure of a specific date.
Well, the requirement to provide the dates first protects the accused in order to present his Sixth Amendment right to a defense. And we know that that has served its purpose once he has been able to present the defense. And again, if the variance impacted it, that would be part of that prejudice analysis. In terms of double jeopardy, they look at the entire record. So here, if we were to apply it in Kershaw, we would see that even if we were to take it to the most extreme that AFCA found, 6 months to a year, this offense occurred in one house, in one room, in one floor, with one victim, one accused, where they only lived under the same roof in a 17-month period of time, bookended by a deployment and her moving into the house. So it would be crystal clear that we're talking about the same incident. So where a child has an infallible memory and is testifying 6.5 years after the offense occurred, we can look at the variance here and make sure that the accused is protected by both his double jeopardy and his Sixth Amendment right to present a defense notice and Fifth Amendment due process right, but also we are not overturning a conviction based upon a technicality that hasn't been proven is prejudicial and in this case is not prejudicial.
Hmm. Thank you.
Any further questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you, Major Levine.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
All rise. The court is adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.